Interpretations at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ken Jones and Patches. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonio Gonzalez, Frida Ross, Brett Pivado, Eric Tagadoff, and of course, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is, of course, Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
Yes, you are. And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, and gosh, why wouldn't you? You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth and have a great night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his latest article, co-authored for the paper this week. It's called PPB Asks City Council to Authorize Emergency Less Lethal Munitions Purchase Despite Existing Stockpile. Announced before holiday weekend, emergency ordinance skirts transparency, authorizes PPB to bolster shields and munitions inventory. Welcome to KBOO News in Depth, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. So your latest article details an emergency vote on the docket with City Council on Wednesday to purchase more of these less lethal munitions used by Portland police to control crowds. What makes this a significant addition to Wednesday's agenda?
Well, this came up on Friday sort of as a surprise, I think, to most people. Portland Police Bureau already has like up to kind of $1.1 million in the budget for these kinds of things, but they need City Council's approval before they can actually move forward and buy any military-style equipment. So this popped up on Friday. It seemed a very interesting time just before a three-day weekend, and then sort of considering the lack of communication from PPB and the city, it just sort of appears as though they're trying to skirt a little bit of public process here.
So looking at this purchase, this emergency purchase, what are some of the reasons that the city is giving for wanting to purchase more of these weapons?
PPB says that they have not replenished their inventory on crowd control munitions since their rapid response team, the riot squad, what have you, resigned in June of 2021. They resigned citing like these ongoing protests, people, police officers being injured, low morale, resigned all at once. And then in March, the city actually sent a letter of agreement or signed a letter of agreement with the police association to essentially reinstate a public order team, a very similar team. So they say that they need to replenish this because it's been a few years. Some of these, their inventory is going to expire soon. And they cited public order events that have been more frequent in recent weeks.
What are some of the specific weapons that they want to purchase?
They're pretty explicit about wanting to purchase some shields. And there's some evidence of wanting to have some vehicle barriers and things like that for crowd control. And then up to and including some other munitions, chemical munitions.
What evidence is there to support that those weapons are in short supply? Does the public have information about what those stockpiles look like?
Yeah, so in December of 2020, just kind of after Black Lives Matter protests and just after that election, a very different city council passed a resolution that required PPB to submit reports to the mayor on a quarterly basis showing what their riot control munitions inventory is. So I'll round a little bit here, but the most recent report that was April 1st of this year, 2024, says that they have like 3,662 specialty less lethal impact munitions with like chemical irritants, 822 launchable pyrotechnic riot control agents, about 1,200 hand toss pyrotechnic riot control agents, and sort of on and on, 176 paint rounds, 2,800 non-irritant impact rounds, like plastic rounds and hard foam rounds. So, and like 2,000 flashbangs. So they seem pretty well equipped.
Can you speak to the significance of this expiration date or things that are expiring? Why does that matter?
It's a little bit interesting because they made a number of pretty large purchases in 2020 for obvious reasons. And so they have a 5-year shelf life. Most of these, they said, are expiring, would expire either between 2022, if they had purchased it in 2017, and then, you know, 2025. So they, Kevin Allen, the PPB information officer, said that they would use these expired munitions in trainings. That's another part of the budget that they're asking to use, is to be able to train people to use, you know, cops to use these munitions. And so, yeah, I mean, they, you know, the fact that they're expiring, some that has not stopped the police and the Portland police specifically in the past from actually using them in what they call the field against protesters. But those can be significantly worse for people's health. They obviously say they're going to use these just for training purposes, and that's a big reason they need to do it. But if you did a big purchase in 2020, it would be the summer of 2025 before they would actually expire.
And this emergency order, this is spending an existing item in the budget, is that correct?
Yeah, it's not a new budget item. They already have that. They just have to get authorization from the city due to that resolution passed in 2020.
Well, as you mentioned, this emergency ordinance, this coincides with the recreation of the Rapid Response Team, or the RRT, which disbanded in 2021. You touched on some of the history there about why RRT disbanded, but they're coming back now. Where are we at in that process?
Yeah, as far as I can tell, there was that March 20th, City Council passed another emergency ordinance, this letter of agreement with the Portland Police Association that essentially brings back a team that they're assembling. Again, Kevin Allen, the PPB PIO, said that they are still in sort of training and outfitting mode. So apparently they don't have a real response team. But for anybody who has seen video or been at Portland State, there's still, you know, a team of people who are ready to push people around if they feel the need to do so.
Right. There have been these protests recently by student activists calling on their universities to discontinue their support of the Israeli government in light of Israel's bombardment of Gaza. And these have been broken up by Portland police. I mean, as recently as last week, this was going on. How does this context play into this emergency order?
The emergency part of this, you know, means that's an important factor here. And that means that essentially they don't have to do like a second reading on this thing. They can just go ahead and vote. And then once they actually vote it in, it can go into effect immediately. So the emergency piece of this does kind of show that they're not just planning for the future, which, you know, it's an election year. There's a lot of planning for the future going on right now around political violence and stuff. But yeah, the timing of this is really interesting with student protests, not just here, but, you know, across the United States, around the world. This first thing that I saw, this letter of, you know, for procurement of these goods for PPV came like March 26, which is, you know, right before kind of student protests were really taking off across the country. But as, you know, protests against violence in Gaza is, we're really starting to pick up. So it does seem to be very much a response to that. And in the, ordinance itself, it says we need to do this now because of protests which have been more frequent in recent weeks.
What is different about this emergency ordinance compared to normal purchasing or agenda items at City Council?
Yeah, this does allow things to go through a lot more quickly and with a lot less public scrutiny. For instance, you know, they like I said before, like we'll just read through it one time. It isn't set out into the future where, you know, this will go into effect at a later date or something like that. It goes right into effect immediately. So to a certain extent, they're just going to be able to buy these, you know, shields and munitions that they want to buy right away. It's already set up to be purchased. There are specific things, these modular shield dolly systems that are $3,800 per shield and hold guns. They're like gun-mounted shields that they want to buy. And it seems they'll be able to just sort of send in that order and pay for it.
Is this something that is supported by the current council? Is there any reason to believe that there'd be no votes on this?
It's a different council than it was in December 2020. That initial thing, resolution was passed. It was introduced by Ted Wheeler and Chloe Daly and Joanne Hardesty. I guess Wheeler is the only person who's still in office there. And I don't know. I guess we'll have to see see what happens.
What do you hope listeners and readers take away from this story?
I guess it's important to, you know, maybe, I think I'd rather quote Juan Chavez, the Civil Rights Project Director at the Oregon Justice Resource Center, who said, you know, police don't solve protests nor make them safer. These weapons maim people and traumatize them from speaking out further. Thousands of people can probably tell you the horror stories wrought by PPV and their weapons from 2020, and the city clearly learned nothing from that experience.
And that quote was from?
That quote is from Juan Chavez, the Civil Rights Project Director at the Oregon Justice Resource Center.
If our listeners are interested in reading the article for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, the best place to get street roots is to buy it from a vendor there in your neighborhood and accept cash, Venmo, and tips. And you can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about the latest article he co-authored for the paper. It's called PPB Asks City Council to Authorize Emergency Less Lethal Munitions Purchase Despite Existing Stockpile. Announced before holiday weekend, emergency ordinance skirts transparency, authorizes PPB to bolster shields and munitions inventory. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBU News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland Youth Philharmonic, America's longest-running youth orchestra, closes its historic 100th season this Friday, May 31st, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The program, titled A Century of Unforgettable Music, includes George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, which is also celebrating its centennial year, and Franz Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, the very first piece performed by the orchestra back in 1924. To preview Friday's concert, we're joined today by David Hatner, PYP's musical director, along with Hunter Nowak and Pink Martini's Thomas Lauderdale, the soloists on Gershwin's Rhapsody. David, just a few weeks ago, we talked about PYP's May 5th concert, which featured four world premieres by contemporary composers. That's quite a contrast with Friday's program, which features works by Schubert, Brahms, Britten, and Gershwin. To me, that's one reason PYP is so important to Portland's classical music community, mixing the old with the new and introducing us to composers we might not often hear in concerts.
It's been a part of the orchestra as long as anyone can remember, and there is no art without renewal. What we have as a repertoire for the orchestra is a distillation of hundreds of years of tens of thousands of works composed. And we hope, anyway, that the best are the ones that are still played today from all those years. But it's impossible to achieve that without playing a lot of new music, some of which will last and some will be forgotten. but we try to study them as hard as we can and make sure that they're appropriate for the students to learn. And the students give the best feedback because they really are objective. They don't have as much reverence for the famous names as older folks do, and not as much skepticism of the newest names as we sometimes do. So that was a great experience, especially for the ensembles we have that don't play as much newer music, which is the preparatory groups for the Philharmonic Orchestra are often playing the more traditional music because it's, in many cases, simpler to prepare. So that was a great accomplishment for all of those musicians to participate in that.
Now, programming this concert seemed to be a monumental task for you. In effect, you're capping off the orchestra's first 100 years and pointing us towards the next 100. Schubert's Unfinished Symphony was the very first piece performed by PYP, then known as the Portland Junior Symphony. That was back in 1924. So that's an easy choice, I think. But why the Brahms, the Britten, and the Gershwin?
Well, I had invited Hugh Edwards to conduct the orchestra on December 26th in the Brahms Academic Festival Overture. It's a work that has been performed many times over the decades of the orchestra and is a central part of the symphonic repertoire. And in addition, it was composed for students to listen to. It was for a graduation exercise in Breslau, where Brahms was given an honorary doctorate degree, and he flavored the work with melodies that the students graduating were familiar with because they sang those melodies while drinking beer. And so they were just delighted that this Dr. Brahms, who was known for the most serious kind of music, would compose a serious piece using music that they knew. So I thought it really fit the spirit of the occasion, since for many musicians, this is a graduation concert. And Hugh was, of course, agreeable to that. And I asked him what piece he would like to bring specifically from his own repertoire. And he chose a piece from his home country, the United Kingdom, Benjamin Britten's 4C interludes from the opera Peter Grimes, which is the opera's a masterpiece. And these four interludes are wonderful as well. So those are the three pieces that Hugh is going to conduct. The Schubert has come back at various anniversaries over the years, so I thought this would be a good one to have it.
Now, Mary Dodge founded the orchestra back in 1924, and Jacques Gershkovich was the first musical director. Do you have any record or notes on that first performance, which included Schubert's Unfinished Symphony?
Only a photograph, and also the newspaper reviews at the time, which were laudatory, and frankly amazed that in such a short time, they started rehearsing in the fall, I imagine, and they gave the concert on February 14th of 1925, that the presentation could be so professional and polished, which I'm sure it became much more so over the next two or three years as they increased the size of the orchestra and so forth. But what we know is that it galvanized the public. They embraced the idea of the orchestra and raised money for it and created a parent organization, an association with a board of directors that was in charge of raising the money to support Mr. Gershkovich's work, as well as making sure the orchestra had a place to store its music and equipment and that it would be a permanent part of our community, which it so far has been.
Now, we talked about Hugh Edwards, who was PYP's third musical director. He served from 1995 to 2002. And I know you've worked with him several times since then. I remember talking with you both in 2018. He was guest conducting a concert celebrating your 10th year with the orchestra at the time. So having him back must be a treat for you and the musicians, and kind of a natural rapport has already been built.
Yes. Hugh is, of course, very well remembered for stepping in as the third conductor after over 70 years and building upon, you know, what was already a very distinguished history with music the orchestra hadn't played before and a youthful exuberance and, of course, a lot of musicians who went on to significant careers. He's worked with student orchestras in many places, including at colleges and universities and the Seattle Youth Symphony for several years. And of course, many years, the Olympia Symphony and the Portland Columbia Symphony. So very experienced very dry sense of humor and a wonderful integrity approach to the music.
Now, along with the Brahms, the Britten, and the Gershwin, so these kind of classical heroes that we all know, Friday's program includes one contemporary piece, Jesse Montgomery's Strum. PYP performed this just last March, about the same time Jesse won a Grammy for Best Contemporary Classical Composition for her 2022 piece, Round, so a different piece. Why did you pick this for the centennial season closer?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to feature the string section of the orchestra, which is sort of its heart and soul. It's the leading voice of any orchestra, but it is particularly prominent in our orchestra for just having a very strong esprit de corps as well as high standards for itself. Also, since we performed it not only here but on tour, it would be very polished and ready to go. And it's just a great piece. It's really a great American composition. Audiences like it. The musicians like it. I like it. And I thought, since the second half is American music with the Gershwin, which also is 100 years old this year, that something fairly new would be an appropriate pairing for that. So we'll open the second half of the concert with Strum by Jesse Montgomery.
Hunter, you and Thomas Lauderdale, who's joining us now, and it's a great privilege, will be performing Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue at Friday's concert. There's usually one soloist on piano for the piece, but on Friday, you and Thomas will both be soloists sharing one piano. I looked it up on YouTube. You both played it without an orchestra at a farewell party for Oregon Governor Kate Brown in 2022.
Oh, yeah.
How did this four hands version originate?
Well, we actually, so Thomas has been playing Rhapsody in Blue since
the 30s.
But with two hands, right?
And so when we were actually working on a project with Oregon Ballet Theater, and we were kind of playing around with different ideas of repertoire. And I can't remember, was it you that suggested, or Niccolo or Kevin that suggested Rhapsody?
Rhapsody in Blue, yeah. But they wanted a longer version of it. They wanted more time for the dancers on stage. Rhapsody in Blue kind of takes 15 minutes or so, depending on how fast you play it. And they wanted 25. And so what we did was a two piano collaboration with Oregon Ballet Theater. And we repeated sections and slowed them down and made the whole thing more balletic.
And more rhapsodic.
and we really liked this sort of version because, you know, Rhapsody in Blue, you know, there's so many ways to play it, but it's really ultimately like a dance piece in a way, and comes out of the 1920s flapper era. And in fact, this is the 100th anniversary of Rhapsody, of the debut of Rhapsody in Blue, because it debuted in 1924. And then out of that, you know, you can't always have two pianos. They take up a lot of real estate. And so we gradually moved to a one piano forehand version, which is actually even better in a way because, you know, we get to interact more. So it's our kind of arrangement that has evolved over the years of Rhapsody in Blue for four hands, one piano, full orchestra. We played it actually several times. We played it with the Philadelphia Orchestra. We played it with the Oregon Symphony. We played it with the San Francisco Symphony, recently Houston Symphony. And we debuted it with the Spokane Symphony, actually, a couple years ago. And so it's great to be playing with the oldest youth orchestra in the country. 100 years of Portland Youth Philharmonic and 100 years of Rhapsody in Blue.
When it came out, and you mentioned that, Thomas, it was kind of came out of the 20s. It was called an experiment in modern music. Gershwin was both into jazz and classical music. He was actually trained as a classical musician. What attracts you to the piece, both you and Hunter?
Well, I just think the themes, I think it's the best sort of American piece, which is at the intersection of jazz and classical traditions. And I think that, I mean, the themes are just so iconic and beautiful from start to finish. It's just, it's riveting and very accessible too. I mean, I've played it since I was 13 years old in different capacities. I even recorded a version with a surf band called Satan's Pilgrims.
Oh, really... I saw the cover. You were taking off on the Beach Boys surfs
right.
up, I think,
right.
holding and, the surfboard and, right. and wearing Hawaiian shirts.
Pendleton.
Oh, Pendleton shirts. Okay, a little more Oregonian. What was it like working with these very young but also very talented PYP musicians?
Well, they're incredible. Like, for example, I can't remember the clarinetist's name, but he's really, really quite something. And you've got a lot of really great soloists in that orchestra, the concertmaster, and the horn section. I mean, it's just a tremendous orchestra with an incredible history. I played years ago when Jacob Ashalomov was the conductor.
Mr. A, David calls him. Yeah.
I played under him, and then under Man Chen as well, who was the conductor maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think she was David's direct predecessor. And then David's been there for 17, 18 years now.
That's right.
Hunter, I want to also ask you, and this is not about Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, but you're the founder of the concert series In a Landscape, Classical Music in the Wild, a very unique classical music series now in its ninth season. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we bring a 9-foot Steinway grand piano on a trailer to parks and beautiful landscapes in the West. And we give the audience wireless headphones so they can listen to the live classical music and wander through the landscape. This year we're doing 50 concerts. We're doing a handful around Portland at the Rose Garden, down at Silver Falls, a couple of wineries, Stoller and Soder.
Warm Springs.
We'll be at Warm Springs Reservation this Saturday, which is actually going to be especially interesting because there are tribal vendors that are there. And then we also have a pre-concert show where two elders they're doing a story circle. And then there's also the amazing Native American award-winning flutist James Edmund Greeley, who will be joining me, and we'll do some improvising together.
Where can people get tickets and find out more about In a Landscape?
Yeah, you can find out more at inalandscape.org, and that's where you can also buy tickets.
Well, David, Friday's concert is billed as a century of unforgettable music. Can you share with us any plans you have to kick off PYP's next century in November?
Well, I have to inform the board of directors and the donors and a few other people, but there are some significant plans. We'll hear another symphony by Ruth Gipps, who was on the program last year. It'll be a local premiere of one of her five symphonies. We'll hear some music by William Grant Still. One of our alumni will return to play the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. And we'll hear a symphony by Brahms all in the course of this year. So something new, something old. And our chamber orchestra, which will play two concerts at the Rieser, will be collaborating again with Llewellyn Sanchez-Werner, the wonderful pianist we've had twice before, in a new concept, a recital for piano and orchestra. So Llewellyn is going to learn six works for piano and orchestra, which is really quite a feat of human endurance and virtuosity. And we'll also collaborate again with our friends at Art Max Academy on some new music for Persian instruments and string orchestra. So I think it's going to be a lot of traditional music and some things that some folks have never heard before, which I think is what we now call a typical Portland Youth Philharmonic.
One last thing, David. I wanted to give a shout out to Alice Fern. She's been PYP's marketing and communications director for the past four seasons. She's leaving PYP next month to pursue some green projects of her own. I just want to say she's been a joy to work with, and I know you join me in wishing her all the best.
Yes, I do. It's always sad. It's like a family at PYP.
Yes.
It's nice to have, you know, somebody so dedicated and so competent in a position that's so important to us, you know, communicating with folks like you and other members of the press, as well as our vendors and the people who advertise with us and many others. So, I know it will be very difficult to replace Alice, and I'm hoping that her successor will have as much luck as she did.
And Alice, I think, would be mad at us if I didn't ask you where listeners can find out more about PYP's Friday concert and purchase tickets if they like for the Schnitzer or the live stream.
Absolutely, including the fact that if you use the code MAYTH31, you can get two tickets for the price of one. You can find the link to all of that on our website, PortlandYouthPhil.org, or you can just Google Portland Youth Philharmonic, and it will take you there, and go to the ticket page, and it will all be cleared. And that, of course, includes tickets to our live stream of Friday's concert.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, and Hunter Nowak and Thomas Lauderdale, who will be performing George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue at PYP's historic centennial season closer this Friday, May 31st, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. You can find out more online and purchase tickets for the Schnitzer or the live stream at portlandyouthphil.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
And you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.